Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new miniseries, The Doctor's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Sam Shee, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
Today, I'm thrilled to introduce Dr. Christine Tsai, a doctor, educator, and mentor whose career exemplifies excellence in medicine. Dr. Tsai is an associate professor of medicine and attending physician of hospital medicine at Rush. She completed her Bachelor of Arts in Biochemical Sciences at Harvard, her Doctor of Medicine at Columbia, and her residency in Internal Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. Over her many years as a practicing physician, Dr. Tsai has demonstrated a devotion to medical education and clinical practice. She has served as the Director of Clinical Skills, Practitioner Role Leader, and the Internal Medicine Sub-I Internship Co-Director, shaping both the preclinical and clinical curriculum at Rush Medical College. She's also worked as a general internal medicine floor attending during this time. Dr. Tsai also embodies a passion for mentorship of numerous medical students, residents, and junior faculty members. Not only have I personally experienced the power of Dr. Tsai as a clinician educator in preclinical curriculum, but I've also experienced her leadership through the bedside clinical skills curriculum. Her preclinical students work to develop interviewing, clinical reasoning skills, and documentation that'll be critical for their clerkship experiences. Dr. Tsai is also always taking the time to connect with me when we bump into each other on the floors or in the parking garage with warmth, curiosity, and care. She's an excellent doctor, but above all else, she's a mentor anyone would be lucky to have in their corner. Dr. Tsai, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so now I have some questions kind of so that the audience can get to know you and we can kind of set the stage. Can you give us a brief roadmap of your training and career thus far to familiarize our guests a bit more with you?
Sure. So I don't know how far you want to go back, but
as far as you want.
I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and then I was at Harvard for my undergraduate, and then I went to Columbia for medical school, and then I went to the other coast, to Oregon, for my internal medicine residency training, and then actually my first job out of residency was here at Rush, and I've been here for the last 12 years.
Amazing. So what's kept you here this entire time?
You know, so when I was looking at jobs, and of course, there's lots of great places to work, but essentially, it's like you look at the people and you look at the culture of a place. And I was very intentional when I was choosing my job to figure out like where I would be, where I would be fully welcome as I am, and just making sure that the mission of the institution was congruent with the things that I valued and I wanted to dedicate my career to.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like that kind of like shopping for like a fit, shopping for like what resonates with what you said to me is like somewhere that will take you as you are?
Yeah.
As like, do you feel like that's something that's pretty transparent to you, like on the interview trail, both when you were like looking at I guess I think of it more relevant to me in terms of like looking at residency programs, looking at jobs. Do you feel like that is like kind of clear to you?
It can take a little bit of sleuthing. Some of it is like you have to figure out who you are at first. So we can get into this, but at some point I thought I was going to be a neurosurgeon, and I was pretty dedicated to that. And I narrowed to neurosurgery and internal medicine, which nobody really understood. But it made a whole lot of sense to me, and it still actually does. Like, there aren't other careers that I would have considered. And but you know, on the interview trail, of course, there's a couple layers, I guess. Sometimes you have a gut feeling about a place, and that very much may be apparent when you're interviewing. Maybe a little bit harder once you're on Zoom, but sometimes you get a gut feeling. Then there is the next layer of research. So one thing an old school professor advised me when I was looking at my job, and I think it's probably still kind of true for residencies, is what is their tagline? And it was so interesting because you can basically get a strong sense of where is like a research heavy place, where are they more about maybe the spiritual component of things, where might they, you know, strive for quality. And of course, most institutions want to do all these things, but in order to be good at something, they sort of have to kind of figure out their mission.
Yeah.
Within the general mission that all institutions want to provide high quality care, they want to do, you know, research forward, frontline work. And of course, they do want to kind of take care of all the mental, spiritual, psychological components of health as well.
And picking a place where their mission aligns with your values. And hopefully if that mission aligns with your values, they'll like nurture you, give you space to like develop that.
Yeah. And then the other thing, sometimes it requires a little extra layer of effort. So I spent a lot of time talking after the initial interview, right? Because any interview, just like anything, like a first date, you could get and you're like, is it worth a second date?
Yeah.
But sometimes a second date goes really well. And sometimes you're like, oh, a first impression with someone was holding it together for their 40 minutes, hour, 2 hours. And then, you know,
totally
the truth comes out.
I even think that it's that it's honestly, it's like that the first date is all adrenaline. Everyone's like on their best behavior. And then it's almost that like kind of second to third. It's when like you, that's when you kind of actually have to get to see people's character.
Correct.
Or an institution's character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not that when I say someone needs to accept me for myself, like they need to necessarily, like I have no room for improvement or anything along those lines. But in general, like for instance, at Rush, I feel like I can pretty much speak my mind in a way that as long as it's respectful and with the intention of helping the place be better, I can be pretty honest about things. And other places are not necessarily as interested in hearing that. So I've heard. I guess I don't have as much in that environment.
But clearly it's carried such that you've stayed here.
Yeah.
For your career, which is great. What does a typical week look like for you?
Oh, gosh. There is no typical week. And some of it's my own doing. So my job is divided. When I first started, I was full-time hospitalist here. And that meant not quite a week on, a week off. We worked about 28 weeks a year. Okay. And 26 would be a week on, a week off. So sometimes we'd have to do more. And then when we're in teaching service, it is for the benefit of the residents. The students, we work try to work 2 weeks in a row. So there was a little bit more clumping. So I was full-time clinical. 50% of my time, I was like working with residents and students on the floors. And then I was doing some consultative medicine for like the surgical services and things like that. And then 50%, I was kind of on my own on a non-resident service.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time now, I've had time bought out to essentially not see patients. And I am 70% in the medical school. So 20% of my time, I am teaching classes, as you've alluded to in my intro. 50% of the time I'm designing the curriculum and designing the assessments and having meetings and trying to make sure that all of it is cohesive in terms of essentially what most people think of as the doctoring program or the physicianship program in most schools. And then 30% of my time I'm now seeing patients. But as a hospitalist, it means like I will work 2 weeks in a row, 14 days straight, and then not do that for, you know, a couple weeks, a couple months even. And then in terms of our pre-clerkship curriculum, it's kind of all over the place. So there's some days I'm teaching two or three different sessions. And then other weeks, like this week, I was initially scheduled for no sessions. But then with some needed coverage, I was like, okay, I guess I'll, you know, pop in and I'll teach this one session.
How did you kind of figure out like that balance for you? Or how did you kind of start like entirely as a attending physician on the floors? And then kind of like, did you always know you wanted to be in the educational space? And then when you kind of describe that split, is the split such that it reflects like what you most enjoy kind of doing? Or is there like, how did you kind of find that balance in your time?
So it kind of happened organically. I would say that, you know, one of the divides that learners often think about is community practice versus academic practice. And community practice is, there can still be a lot of education involved depending on the specific microenvironment that you're in. But more or less, you know, that job is seeing patients. And some people just love that. You know, they don't necessarily want to engage with learners. Rather, like delegating is like a totally different task and skill set than it is to just do it yourself, right? So some people were like that. You also generally make more money out in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want that kind of work-life balance, you're just like when you're at work, you work, you're on your own with colleagues and all these wonderful things, of course. Or else in academics, there's a lot more. What I had heard once early in my career was that you get your time bought out to not see patients. And I chose academics because it was the easiest. I'd only trained in academic centers, and so it was easier to find people to email to submit my resume to. So sometimes it's just what you know. And then in terms of med ed, I did specifically pick my Rush job because I was given a lot of floor teaching time from the get-go. It's actually very competitive to try to get floor teaching time. Mm-hmm. A lot of us want it. It's really fun to engage with learners. But as a consequence, like at other institutions, when I was applying, and part of the reason I chose Rush is I mentioned I used to have like 14 weeks of teaching time, and other places were offering me like 2 to 4 weeks. And then I thought, well, if I'm only going to do 2 to 4 weeks, I might as well just be out in the community then at that point. And it's hard to really get your career off the ground. Then from there, once I chose to sort of be in an academic center like Rush, there are questions of if you want to go to administrative research or med ed.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of did a little bit of everything. I was doing some quality work. I was doing some administrative work for my division. And then I was dabbling in med ed. And over time, at some point, you, or at least for me, I just tried all of them. Part of being an internist is not knowing, like, having a very specific thing that I want to focus on. And so that was true for my career, too, that I was like, I'll dabble in this, dabble in that. And at some point, I was like, oh, there's certain things that I always wanted to delegate away. Like, anything regarding schedules, I just wanted to, like, send that to somebody else. Whereas I have other colleagues who, like, they get really excited about solving the puzzle of our schedules. And so then I realized, okay, I'm not really interested in, like, sort of division administration, hospital administration. Mm-hmm. I did some quality work, but I wasn't really interested in going fully down the IRB route and doing that kind of work. And then med ed was just, it was just fun. It was really the first year of our sort of flipped classroom curriculum where I was teaching the classroom that, you know, I didn't have any official teaching experience, but I just related to being with students and I like the energy that you guys provide. And we were kind of all in it together at the time. And, yeah. And so I just really enjoyed that. And then it kind of took off from there.
Awesome. Awesome. And then this question is a little bit of a backtrack, but I'm asking this selfishly for my own curiosity. And maybe this is, again, more relevant to medical students. But you kind of described this early fork in the road between internal medicine and neurosurgery and how other people kind of like would be like, those are so different.
Yeah.
Like, I guess for people that are, I guess I'm an M3 and people are, we're at this like kind of heavy point of the year where people are now deciding where they want to apply for residency. And that can feel like a very heavy decision. At least I experienced it that way.
Yeah.
How did you make that decision for yourself?
So I spent a lot of time talking to a lot of people, and then some people give you that aha moment. So for me, I spent all of third year, I pretty much liked everything. The only one I couldn't do was pediatrics, and I'm so grateful to my pediatric colleagues. Like, kids are so cute, but I was just like, actually very stressful to take care of these young children. Whereas I found adults just easier to take care of. So I, that's the only thing I ruled out of all, like, I think I had like 13 rotations or something. I was like, that's it, that's all stuff. Not very helpful. But of course, you think about what you like and you think about what you don't like. So think about the best part of the job. Think about the worst part of the job. Think about what the job's going to look like in 10 years, which is also a weird thing to think about. But like when you're done with training, like what is that job going to look like? So for me to bring it down to a little bit more specific, it's like, so I went into med school. I really liked neurosurgery. I liked craniectomies. I liked spine surgery. I liked tumors. I thought it was very neat. I liked the OR culture. It was very, very fun. I actually thought I wasn't going to do medicine at all. I was like, why would I want to deal with these lifestyle problems? I was really kind of internally snotty at the time. I wanted to do something that I was like, oh, you know, I can cut people open. They can't do this for themselves. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But then, so as a personal experience, my mom was diagnosed with cancer right before my first year of medical school. And that kind of like overshadowed most of my medical school years. She passed away during my third year. And I interacted, therefore, from the patient's family perspective with a lot of different kinds of doctors. And I saw oncologists that I wanted to be like and ones that I did not want to be like. And I felt very inspired to be like, oh, I could be like this very specific kind of oncologist that I saw out in the community that was like amazing towards my mother and all of her patients. And I was like, oh, I could build that practice. Just I felt very inspired by that. So that's how I kind of got into maybe more medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was going to do oncology, actually, very specifically within that. And I was like, oh, give people chemo if they need, or maybe. It was all a very long-winded way of saying. Then I was like chatting, I was like, what do I do? You know, I thought about neurology, and I was like, I don't think those are the diseases that I really wanted to dedicate myself to. I thought about general surgery, because maybe the training is a little bit shorter, especially as a woman. Maybe I don't want to be in training for so long. But ultimately, I discovered if I want to do surgery, I just really liked neurosurgery, and that was going to be the surgery for me. And then within medicine, I think I just wanted that vision of feeling like, oh, I can build my own practice and have this whole community that I'm creating. So I narrowed it to those two. And then it was actually a senior female neurosurgery resident that gave me my aha moment. So most people say, even, you know, most surgeons, I think, will say, if you like anything else just as much, go do that other thing.
Oh, I've heard that many times.
Right. I think that has not changed in many decades because surgery, you know, it's an amazing field, but it is a lot of personal sacrifice and the hours you have to work and all those sorts of things. So I was like, I don't know. I really like the OR. It's like really, really fun. But this neurosurgery resident, she flipped it around for me. She's like, well, you're not sure if you can't live without the OR, but like, what about not talking to patients? I was like totally flabbergasted. I was like, wait, what? Not talking to patients? And she was like, yeah, because in your senior years, like your job is to get really good at these surgeries and to be able to practice independently and operate independently as an attending. So all that like floor work, you're delegating that to the junior residents. And you are in and out of the OR like day in and day out. Like that is your job. And that to me was like, then I reflected and I realized, oh yeah, I am the type of person to dabble in a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I'm not the person who has just done the same thing over and over again, right? I've never been a star athlete. I'm not a star musician. And, you know, those sorts of transferable skills that people have from building these habits of doing the same thing over and over and over again. Like that was never me personality wise, like from the get go. And then that was my like, oh, okay. Well, now I know. Apparently talking to patients is a non-negotiable for me. And then I decided to go to the internal medicine route. And then from there I thought, oh, well, I was going to do hemonc and I had this whole vision. But I realized within hospital medicine, I can do a lot of that sort of really deep discussion that I really enjoy with patients.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, oh, well, then I can just finish my training 3 years earlier and become an adult 3 years earlier because the road is long. But yeah, some people thought, you know, are you sure you want to be done? I had a really lovely professor who asked me if I was depressed because I was going to fellowship. He was very cute. He didn't mean it in any kind of like harmful way. But I was like, no, just... you know, be an adult right now and I'm ready to, you know, do hospital medicine. There's been pros and cons to that. You know, I think if I had done fellowship, I'd have a more clear sense of my specialty. On the other hand, there's value in being a generalist and kind of seeing the forest from the trees.
Yeah. Everything that you're saying resonates a lot with me. And I'm kind of starting that, like, I don't know. Yeah. There have been little moments here and there and like little glimmers of aha moments and like similar moments where even like, if you get the wrong cook in the kitchen with you, then it even kind of muddles things more.
Mm-hmm.
And then you finally have the right person kind of like directing your thought processes. And but this podcast is about you. I'm not going to start pivoting it towards me. But yeah, I think a lot of what you just said is super relevant to like not just third year medical students, but I even think people like, because I was talking to, I had an amazing experience on my IM rotation. It was my first one. I didn't even like kind of plan it coming.
But then I saw you on the floor at my office.
And like, yeah, exactly. And I was just like having a great time. And I actually, all of my interns and like the residents I work with on IM are still the people that like are the happiest to see me when I'm walking around the hospital like today.
I love that.
And so like my attendings from like May and June of 2024, not only have I been able to like reach out and speak to, but even like some of the interns that I had. And so in asking one of the interns for advice about like picking, kind of deciding what to do with residency, she was kind of facing all of the same kind of like, I guess like decision trees that you just described, but like they're relevant from medical school to residency. They're relevant in residency to like deciding for fellowship. They're relevant when you're trying to find a job after graduating.
Yeah.
So I feel like I am highlighting that like the ability to have very earnest internal reflection is relevant at like every stage of like learning your career.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, so to backtrack up, when I was picking my residency, I went up to Oregon. I didn't know anyone there. I actually spent a lot of time because we talked about the initial like gut feeling, but the afterwards was like I spoke with like multiple different residents who were there to be like, what was your experience like transitioning there? I was like, I'm not going to know anybody. Like, am I going to regret this? And you know, they were also all what we call transplants in the sense that they were like, yeah, I came from one place and I didn't know anyone there. And it's been amazing. And I was like, okay, these are people I could be friends with, which I really liked about. And that was the sort of afterwork of like, is this something potentially sustainable? With careers, it's sort of the same thing. There's a couple things, actually. One, yes, there's pressure to pick like the right thing for you, but you can, like, you could probably do a lot of things and have a really fulfilling career. So I think I could have been a neurosurgeon and still been very happy at the end of the day. I probably could have picked general surgery and found something and been very, very happy. You know, now I think I could have been PM&R or psychiatry and I could have been very, very happy. And because like within that, like a lot of us have like lots of different interests. So, you know, there are some people who come into med school, they know what they want to do and they are still going for it. But those of us that are wandering around kind of unsure, I think it's nice to know that there's lots of different pivot points where you can be like, oh, maybe I'll do this or that. And really either road you take is totally fine and will still be congruent with like who you are.
Yeah.
That sort of makes sense. There's lots of great places. And I was like cycling between three and I don't know, they're all so different. What does happen over time, though, is that, you know, med school, I think the odds are against you. You're just trying to get in. And like any place that will take you, you're so grateful to be there.
Yeah.
And certainly now in residencies for the very competitive specialties, it's probably still that way. But other specialties that are arguably maybe a little bit less competitive, you can be a little bit more about fit. And it really goes both ways because the program also wants to have residents that are a good fit for them.
Yeah.
So you just have to do your research and, you know, invest the time in talking to people. and those little aha moments that you never know when they're going to show up and where they're going to come from.
No, and, like, I think that that's a reflection of, like, you and your character, too, that you could, like, I could have, you, like, have a happy career as a neurosurgeon, had a happy career in internal medicine. Now, like, you could have been a psychiatrist. Like, that's also just, like, it's intellectual curiosity. It's, like, knowing yourself. And I think, like, having a strong internal compass so that no matter what you're doing, you find, like, your niche or you find, like, your spot in whatever field you're in.
And then I had mentioned figure out the worst parts of the job and what the job looks like in 10 years. And that was advice I got from, I think, one of my cardiology attendings in residency, who had actually been an infectious disease doctor in South Africa. And then he came here and was like, but that, there's, as you can imagine, a lot of multi-drug resistant organisms and post-op infections. He's like, that's not the kind of medicine he wanted to practice. So then he switched to cardiology because he had to do some more training anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought about that. And then it was actually when I was a senior resident, one of my interns wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon, but she felt like the direction that cardiology was going in was a lot of endovascular work. So then she was like, actually, I want to be an interventional cardiologist. Like, she kind of had a sense of, like, she wanted to work at the heart. She's like, what direction is it going in?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was actually the reason that I stepped away from surgery a little bit, because I really liked open surgeries. And a lot of stuff was moving at the time.
Robotics
and minimally invasive,
which,
you know, some people love that. My husband plays video games. He's all into screens. And again, I was like, I just like it in front of me, more like a craft.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, of course, there's still plenty of open surgeries. And again, I could have found something within that would have been fine. So some of these reasons that I'm coming up with are kind of arbitrary, right? I just made up a reason to not like something. And because you have to choose, you have to decide anyway, you have to make up a reason and pick one that at least feels somewhat through, right?
Yeah. And that feels right. Like, you're making a decision and it kind of feels like a gut instinct.
Yeah.
Right. I could go on this tangent for a long time, but
a whole separate podcast about that.
I'll kind of pivot to asking some questions about clinical reasoning, what's bringing us to this podcast. So how did you begin building your clinical reasoning skills, and what has stood out to you as the most important component in formulating a clinical impression when you meet a patient?
How did I build it? You know, honestly, I don't know how I built it. I distinctly remember as a third year, someone asking me what was on my differential diagnosis. And my response was, in my head only, what's a differential diagnosis? Nobody planned this mean proof clerkship. And I was like, and so I very much made the effort to try to do that for you all. That was my question. As a third year medical student, I wasn't even a first year or second year medical, a differential diagnosis. The list of diagnoses that are possible. So a lot of it was just brute force up front of just trying to come up with any diagnosis. I wasn't given any framework for organizing my thought process. A lot of things that I try to teach in the pre-clerkship about, do you go by probability or by organ system or whatever it may be. But so I think it depends, so some of it is just experiential. You start to get a quick gut sense of what's going on. But to do a good job, you always have to ask yourself, what if I'm wrong? Even if you're I'm really fairly certain that this is a heart attack or a, heart failure exacerbation, because everything is pointing towards that. There's always got to be that question in your mind, a little bit of humility of what if I'm wrong? It is easier to do that when you're I don't know what the diagnosis is. So then you have lots of possibilities because you have to think about them all.
And you don't anchor because you actually don't know.
Yeah, you're right, exactly. You cannot prematurely close your diagnosis or anchor because you're I don't know what's going on. So you have to go through systematically. But for the ones that were fairly certain what is going on, you always got to know. You got to think about, what if I'm wrong? The other thing to think about is you ask whys until you run out of whys. So I commonly will see with learners, and medical school trains us to be this. We have multiple choice questions for a long time. We have step exams. There's one right answer. But in real life, it's good to maintain that curiosity, which is if someone will say a student will be or any learner, intern sometimes, randomly this person has anemia. I'm going to give a unit. And it's why do they have anemia? And sometimes people be crickets and they haven't really thought about it. Or maybe more commonly is they have anemia, but it doesn't need a transfusion. So they're just it's anemia, it's stable. And I'm well, but why? And they're okay, did you check iron studies? Did you put the B12 folate in? Do you at least know the responses to them? Anemia, chronic disease. And then from there, why do they have anemia chronic disease? Or why do they have iron deficiency anemia? You got to add those until you run out, and then you're done thinking about the problem. So for me, clinical reasoning at least gets down to the point where I no longer know or no longer need to know the underlying cause. And that's really, really important to be, I think, a good clinician. Those are probably two of the main ones.
Something that like what you're saying resonates with me is I feel like there's this pressure, especially speaking from the medical student perspective, in the classroom that then carries over to the clinical floors, that you feel like you have to have the right answer. Like, not only do you have to have the right answer and that there's one right answer, but you have to have it as quick as possible. And like, you have to say it, like, you can't, you know, it's kind of like,
yeah.
You're describing this like curiosity of like the why, and it actually makes you like a more thorough clinician, or it really makes you like only more thorough, but more like you're being safer, you're being like thoughtful, you're entertaining like other perspectives, you're kind of just being really broad so that you've thought of as many things as possible. I feel this pressure that like in the classroom, you're supposed to only speak up if you know the right answer, there's one answer. Get there as fast as possible and say it with like out even a glimmer of like unsureness. That's not how I operated in undergrad at all. And I came here and that culture was just a little bit different and it took some adjusting to. And it was never me. And I kind of tried to follow like more my instinct that I had, like that kind of curiosity thing onto the floors. And it helped a lot, but I still kind of find this like friction sometimes with it. And I'm sure because you give the medical students like the auntie culture, the kind of like the flash mm-hmm. culture that there's like, you're supposed to kind of have this like. So I guess my point with that more is that it's really refreshing to hear that like being curious and like being thoughtful and being open to be having multiple answers actually makes you seems to make you like a better clinician. But like fighting that kind of, I feel like, I don't want to use the word shame, but like fighting that kind of like embarrassment or shame with like having questions or like being unsure or kind of like, I like to like percolate in the like, in the soup of it all. And then after that kind of gives me a little bit of like joy.
Yeah.
But
it's a tricky balance, you know, because I think sometimes to say I don't know in a way that is confident requires this underlying confidence, right? Because some people say I don't know and it just feels sad. Like, in residency, there were times where I just didn't feel confident at all. And I'd be like, I don't know. And one piece of feedback I got from an attendant was like, she's like, Christine, you often will say, I don't know. But then you talk more and you do know. I don't know why you say, I don't know. And for me, it was, you know, sometimes residents really pummeled you or you're tired. Like, I don't know what's going on. And so, you know, to be able to say, I don't know in a way that still conveys confidence is there's an art to it. And same thing with coming up with the differential. It's like, on one hand, you want to be thorough, but if someone is a little too thorough to the degree that it shows that they don't know what's going on, and they can't then just say, I don't know what's going on, because I will absolutely call colleagues sometimes and be like, I'm calling you because I've tried this, 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 and this, and I don't know what's going on. But at least there was a sense of like, okay, I know what I know, and then here's the limit to what I don't know. But some people actually just walk in without any knowledge, and then that actually is not a great place to be in. Shame is a challenging thing, because none of us came here to look like we don't know what we're talking about. And so where's the balance, right? Like, how do you, for instance, in, even with patients, how do you give them a sense of like, okay, on one hand, I want you to have confidence in me as your doctor that I'm going to take care of you and do a good job and we'll get to the right diagnosis, but also enough so that I'm not just like prematurely closing and making them feel like this doctor doesn't know what they're talking about either. So I think it's important to still have done your reading. Some mistakes that people have is just not having the fundamental medical knowledge. Then after doing the reading, you have to really think about just, there's a little bit of logic and common sense in that kind of probability. Like, it's probably, like, most likely it's this. And that framework of, like, most likely, most scary, like, must not miss things, and then kind of, like, everything else, I think still holds true. You have to learn to communicate pretty efficiently. So some people, sometimes efficiency is the speed with which you talk, and sometimes it's just the words that you choose to use, and that can actually be very helpful in, you can very quickly give a differential diagnosis without actually taking up a lot of time. Because I think there's also, you know, huge time pressure to get things done well. And there are some things that are like, okay, like if you know somebody like cut off their toe, then there's not a lot of differential for that. But then your differential is actually more on like, what are the complications that I have to worry about? And what are the superimposed either infections or otherwise that I have to, you know, deal with?
Yeah. The broadness of internal medicine, I remember when I first started, it was like terrifying, because I remember that like first day I was like, it's just, you could think about everything. Every system was addressed, sometimes in one patient, but especially when we were rounding and if we had a really long list, everything would be there. And I remember like, I was like, God, like that's crazy. But then as time goes on too, I now kind of find it like exhilarating or kind of like a fun kind of challenge. But yeah, the fact that you have to consider everything is crazy.
It is definitely a lot. It's a huge cognitive load too. So
yeah,
it is not easy.
So what is a diagnostic strategy or framework you rely on when faced with a particular challenging case? And do you have a case in mind that was particularly tough, and kind of can you reflect on maybe how you got to a differential or what tools you kind of used to get there?
So one thing we haven't talked about is where the patient fits into all of this. One thing that is increasingly common is that we are rounding in the team room away from the patient.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's for efficiency's sake, right? Some of the learners have to be placing orders, calling consults, doing other things, computer work. And sometimes we want to be looking at the images and we just want to have that technology at our fingertips. It can also psychologically feel a little bit faster, but oftentimes I think it is a pretty big mistake that we are thinking we're being efficient and we're talking about the patients in the room. And then all of a sudden it's like, but the key person that we're talking about is not there. They're not seeing like how much effort we are putting into the discussion. And then we go in for like three minutes afterwards and be like, here's what we think is going on. Here's the plan. What do you think? And they're like, okay, doc. And then you step out, but they don't see the 30 minutes or hour we spent talking about them beforehand.
The med student saw you, the intern saw you, the senior resident saw you. Now we're talking about you for 40 minutes. And this is actually how we came here.
That's the things that we're doing. And I think a lot of times the right answer lies with the patient, I think, is where I'm going with this. It's that, and sometimes it has to do with more of the plan. Right? Like sometimes there's evidence-based medicine. There's a science to it. But there's also a huge art. And sometimes it's like, well, sometimes I'll be like, I'm 50-50 on stressing this person. Do I do a stress test, cardiac stress test on this person? Do I do it inpatient? Do I do it outpatient? There isn't necessarily a clear right answer. And oftentimes going to the bedside is absolutely the right thing to do because, one logic could be, look, if you're going to come right back, 2 days from now because we didn't do this stress test because this chest pain is ongoing, but let's say we don't think it's acute coronary syndrome, maybe we should just do the stress while you're here. Otherwise, some people are like, no, it's totally fine. Like, I have things I want to do at home, given that it's not an active heart attack, which is my biggest concern, and it's not a pulmonary embolism, which is my biggest concerns, I'm going to go home and I can just do this next week, no problem. And we could dilly-dally in the team room for like a long time debating the pros and cons of doing the stress test now versus later. But honestly, the patient can just like tell us what we should do. So sometimes that happens for, in some ways, more straightforward cases, but in my mind, it saves us a lot of time and it gives us more bandwidth to be thinking about other things when we engage the patient. I'm trying to think if there was a case where that was actually the most helpful thing in diagnosing somebody. And I'm not sure I could think one off of the top of my head. But in general, I find that engaging the patient is very, very helpful. Some of it is that then you get, it would make sense, right? You can get a little extra history. And maybe that little bit of history is enough to be like, oh, now I understand what the diagnosis is. Or what it's most likely to be, or now I know who I'm supposed to call or what I'm supposed to do. Maybe so often I think you just get a little extra history and it's happening in real time versus if we do it in the team room, we then have to remember what we were going to ask the patient, then walk over to the patient and then still try to re-remember. Did somebody write down what we were going to ask the patient? Because I've now thought of like 17 other things in between the time that we thought of the original question for the patient and that.
I love this theme of like back to bedside in general. And the fact that like speaking from the medical student perspective, the privilege that I had in carrying two or three patients, three at most, was that I got to spend so much time at the bedside. And when like interns and residents were like doing the brunt of the work during the day, if I got sent to go do a task or ask a question, I could linger in the room for sometimes I liked like 10 minutes, 15 minutes because I was getting that question, but also like establishing a relationship with the patient. And then one question leads to something else. And I get to come back and like tell, like yap this story to the intern or the resident who has like 8 patients, 10 patients. But it's like that back to bedside and also using a diverse clinical team to have the right people kind of be doing those things. But the other thing when you were speaking about this that made me kind of think was like, I feel like sometimes I've been in learning environments where like either a resident or an attending will be teaching me something at bedside with the patient. Like, oh, take the example, like listen to a murmur or like a physical exam finding. And they'll be doing the teaching to me and kind of like, as they say, talking shop. And sometimes I think that there's this like dissonance between like, you don't want to talk too much shop or too much medicine and make the patient feel like excluded or kind of like, I don't know, but like, maybe I'm biased in that if I was a patient, I guess, like, as I am now, I would want to be most privy to, like, all those decision-making things.
Yeah.
Want to hear all those things. So I don't know if that's just more my bias because I'm a medical student and I'm envisioning myself as a patient. I would want the whole team like rounding in my room for 30 minutes. Okay. And otherwise, you're sitting there during the day and like you just said, like everyone's working really hard. But like, I feel like even when like attendings have been talking shop to me explaining like, what is lower extremity edema and like, how do you look for it? And what is it really reflecting in like a heart failure patient? Mm-hmm. That's teaching too, that like, that can also be teaching like for the patient so that if they go home and have another heart failure exacerbation, yeah, they know what like pre-tibial, like they know what tibial edema is.
Exactly. So,
and maybe, yeah, you have to change a little bit of the way that you teach it, but that's teaching for the patient too.
Yeah.
And the med student. So I think it's like, I don't know. I think that people should be like at bedside as much as possible.
It would be lovely. But there's a couple things. You know, we've talked about shame. So you have to be very careful because we don't want learners to feel like they're being put on a spot in a way that embarrasses them in front of the patient.
Yeah.
Right. Although honestly, like usually the patients are loving it. You know, I usually go in and my spiel says something always like, you know, we're going to present you now. So sometimes we don't get to do it on every patient. There just isn't the time. Yeah. But when we do, I'll be like, we're going to present your case. Or I usually try not to say case because that kind of makes it very technical and not very personal. But we're going to present your story as we've heard it. Usually it's like an overnight admission where we're all getting to know you. I mentioned that we're going to use medical language so that we're not constantly having to like reinterpret for the patient. Like, but we will definitely come back and speak in layman's terms when we're done presenting. Please listen along. If there's anything you have questions about, feel free to interrupt. And so it generally goes very, very well. We generally kind of screen as well to make sure the patient is appropriate for that kind of thing. Because if we're going to have somebody who they're going to get anxious as we come up with our differential diagnosis, we try to make sure that whatever we present is done in a way that is not going to add to their anxiety. But as you mentioned, yeah, for the most part, they really like it. Patients like to know that we've spent time thinking about them, right? They don't want to feel dismissed. And just knowing that we're standing there as a team, presenting their case, going through things very thoroughly, talking about our thought process, and then turning it back to them and doing all that education, I think it really makes them feel like the positive energy of an academic environment, mm-hmm, and all that sort of youthful energy and all the care that we're putting in to making sure that they're getting good care. And it generally actually goes very, very well. And then I actually think, personally, I think it saves some time. As long as we are having someone at the computer to still place orders, that if someone needs to go away to like call a consult or do other work, they're free to do that. It doesn't slow down efficiency or inefficiency because it's not like we have to then go back and tell the patient the plan. Because then when we leave the room, we're done with the day. And of course, you can go back in the afternoon to socialize, check in, and look for updates. But it's no longer, I have to go back like sometime earlier in the day to be like, just so you know, we're getting a CT scan on you. Or just so you know, we're ordering this other thing. Because otherwise that happens too. Where sometimes patients are like, whisked away to this thing. And we're like, we didn't have time to tell you. We made the decision. We put in the order. And we thought we'd have like an hour before we could pop in.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, like, you know, downstairs in the procedures, they're like, ready to go. Go off.
And they're like, wait, what are we doing?
What are we doing? Why are we doing this? I have no idea.
I've seen them round. And I haven't had time like in a MICU yet.
Mm-hmm.
I see them like whenever I see like, or SICU, MICU, I see them like in these like, like rolling deep with like the, and someone's rolling, a few people are actually rolling with the computers and this whole team. Why can't we do that like on a GMF service? Is it just like
some places do? Okay. I mean those computers are really heavy though. That's not the limiting factor though. So it has to be, the computers don't work. Sometimes, you know, there's lots of issues with just getting, you know, right now our medicine floors are all on one floor for like GMF. So it's actually, you could roll this, but like carrying it up and down the elevators and all those other things, it can be kind of time consuming. And actually these days, sometimes you could just do it on your phone, right? You could do it on or like the computers in the room if they're working.
Yeah. Yeah. Feet. And I like, this is a little bit of a pivot, but something I've noticed in being like, being at an academic institution, being a student and trying to think about how learning shouldn't get in the way of clinical care. And in this conversation we're having, actually learning can sometimes, like, I want to believe, like, learning can actually make clinical care, like, better. But I've been on some services or in some specialties where I feel like the vibe that I get, or maybe their perspective, either because of an efficiency thing or, like, the genuine constraints on their time that they have,
mm-hmm,
which I'm not a resident, so I don't know, is that learning to them gets entirely in the way, mm-hmm, of the clinical care they're trying to provide, or, like, the time that they need to be somewhere, or the physical things they need to.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you have like, I don't know if you have like a thought or an idea, like to me, and again, very biased, but like I am as the most like IM was the best learning experience I've had in the entire hospital. Not only like in terms of how much I was learning every single day, but the fact that I felt that like my learning was hand in hand a part of like the care that we were providing to people.
Yeah.
But I've been in other services where I've actually spent like maybe a 10 or 12 hour day, like almost in dead silence. And learning how to be a learner in that environment was a different kind of thing. And I had to kind of figure that out. But I guess like as an educator, do you have a thought as to like, why are there certain specialties where like it just goes hand in hand so well, or like, and like maybe because you're in yours, but do you have a thought as to like, is that why is that the culture in some things? Does it have to stay the way?
I think it's the business of medicine, unfortunately. So it's the drivers. Because so one thing, it was my dad or somebody taught me, was like, nobody shows up to do a bad job, basically. So I would assume that even on your most quiet service, like, nobody's super excited to just, like, show up to work and, like, just do work and not talk to anybody. But they do it out of a certain necessity, right? And where does that necessity come from? You know, we all know healthcare is a very expensive industry. It's very, you know, we worry about how do we keep the lights on? Hospitals are closing, reimbursements are down. Yet it is, like, a huge part of our country's, like, expenditure. And so it's just a very complicated thing that we're working with. And at the end of the day, you know, physicians, even in academic centers, are measured on productivity.
Hmm.
And it's not even like, so my personal salary does not change all that much with my productivity. It does in some places, but that's not the main driver. It's that like hospitals operate on very small margins. And mm-hmm. if physicians don't work that hard, then the hospital might close half the time, right? Like it actually does make a difference in order to provide that high quality care. Like a good institution needs money to provide high quality care. So it's, you know, sometimes it gets flipped into this sort of like sinister thing, like, oh, the big bad money makers or the admin just wants to make money. Yeah, there's some truth to that, but like, why do they want to make money? Like it's a nonprofit. Like at the end of the day, we want to do it so we can provide good care
mm-hmm.
and take care of each other and take care of our patients and offer like good services. But so at the same time, if we're being, we as individual providers, you know, physicians, et cetera, are being asked to provide care to the degree that is almost not humanly possible, it makes it very hard to have much by way of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that learners often do slow us down. So, and that's part of the learning process. Not everyone who is in a residency is there to be an educator. It is certainly part of the job of every resident is to be an educator, but that doesn't mean that's what they like about the job. And then learners also need to know that there's a, you know, now that I have more of a global view of, like, you know, each class is 150 students and I've seen many classes over the years, there's a certain responsibility of getting your work done in order to be prepared to engage in the conversation. So, you know, for instance, the running joke is always that internal medicine rounds go on forever. And I would say my rounds go for a very long time, but I also don't want them to go on for a very long time. I also have other things to do. I'd rather be at the bedside and sitting here just like, you know, talking or listening to a presentation on a patient that I already know because I already looked into Epic and I already read all about it. But it's part of the process. So sometimes we do it. So that, like, for instance, if you're my third year, then I know that, okay, Sam's able to give a, you know, solid presentation. And once I know you can give a solid presentation, I'm no longer interested in your presentation skills and I'm more interested in like decision-making skills and all those sorts of things. But there are some learners that have not done the pre-rounding appropriately and they have not looked to see what all the consultants have recommended by the time morning rounds have started. And then the rounds go longer because they're just not prepared for rounds. And so it's a mix of, I think every learner needs to know both like what it means to be prepared, to be willing to put in that time to show up early enough to be prepared for rounds. And then it's also very important to understand what it means to look good and to be helpful for that service. So I've had some learners who typically was the ones who were actually not prepared, who then wanted to take on more patients. And so each of their presentations, instead of being like, if I had an intern or a senior, I'd be like, okay, this is super quick, like, you know, blah, 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 we'll talk. And then we're done talking about this patient so we can spend more time. Like some patients are sitting there, they're waiting for placement or they're diagnostically, like they're on a plan and they're getting better. They just need more time in the hospital. So I don't need to spend a lot of time on those patients. And then we have more bandwidth for the really complicated ones. But these learners who are so sweet, I mean, you know, they just want to be liked. They just want to do a good job, but they're trying to take on more patients. Like, you can't even handle the one. So no, I'm not going to give you a second one. Even though, yes, we say in the paperwork you should have 2 to 4, but you got to be able to handle the first one. And so as a learner, there's a little bit of that. But yeah, I think for the specialties that don't talk, I mean, some of it's the personalities that choose it. People who, you know, given that the reason to go, I went into internal medicine is because I discovered I couldn't not talk to people. It's a naturally maybe a little bit more social. And then I think that, yeah, the ones who are quiet, sometimes it's out of necessity, sometimes it's a little bit of personality, and sometimes it's like they just have to keep their head down and like get through the day, otherwise they're not going to get through the day. Yeah. It's not going to be sustainable for them.
Yeah.
And it's not really a personal thing.
I mean, that could be a lesson for life, but just not like take 90 something percent of the time, not taking those kinds of things like personally at all, or like learning through like observation and through time, like you just kind of said, like, how do you actually be of service to the service that you're on or in the specialty that you're in? And sometimes it is like, sometimes there's a time and a place to like create some, like turn something into a teaching moment. And then there are other times where like a skill that I had to learn to a like crazy degree on certain services was like anticipating. And I feel like I actually learned this most when I was working in like restaurants and in catering in high school and in college, was like this idea of like anticipating people's needs before they even like articulating that they need them, which in some ways is challenging. And I think like, but like once I kind of like got that and it came much more naturally to me, is that like you then they're like, oh, you are like an asset to this because you're anticipating my needs even before like I'm even extending the energy to articulate them. And I mean, there's a catch to that, which is like this whole like idea of like mind reading, you know, like you can't entirely read people's minds, but that's when I really felt like I was getting in the swing of things, even especially in services where like I wasn't like, wait, like why aren't we sitting and talking about this and that? Or like, why aren't we turning every like x-ray that we're reading into like an opportunity to kind of like learn and see what's going on?
Yeah.
But that's something I think I learned from like restaurants and like hospitality, this idea of like, if you're on a team of people and you're working and you're flipping tables, you're kind of like, can't, like you're just doing this like grueling work throughout the night, is like, you're just like, yeah, how do you like anticipate the people needs that you're serving before they're even saying them, and the people around you, what do they need?
Right.
And like, that's when a team feels really like fluid too.
Yeah. I mean, so situational awareness is what you're talking about. And that is key, right? Because actually I did some of my best teaching because I don't know which services you're talking about, but on surgical services where they're really, really busy and I can envision some very quiet days, I did some of my best teaching. I mean, like some of my best experiences were like in the OR, we're like talking about what kind of music we're going to play, people are talking about their weekends, because it would be a time in the operation where they're just kind of doing routine work and not the critical component, right? You don't ask this question in the key moment of the surgery that when the attending surgeon needs to be there. Like, that is a time to be quiet and just observe and like really try to pay attention. But there are other times that like before and after, you're kind of chilling a little bit more. Yeah. And some of the surgeons actually, like it was actually my surgical senior resident my third year who taught me how to give a one-liner. Like, not internal medicine that gave it to me. He was like, this is what you say. This is the structure that you use. And I've, of course, modified it for internal medicine. But fundamentally, it was a surgeon that taught me how to do a one-liner. It was, I was on urology when I was given the, how to place orders. And there's, the vitamins A, B, C, D, E, K kind of stuff. Like, all those different acronyms. Like, it was actually surgeons who sat down. Part of it, if you make their life easier, then they will be happy to give back, right? Because at the end of the day, even the most disgruntled resident who is being crapped upon left, right, and up and down, they have that positive interaction with the learner who's is excited and enthusiastic, right? Because as the learner, you can infuse positive energy into people who are tired. We don't always think of it like that, right? Because they're just like, I just don't want someone to get pissed off at me. I think that there's definitely just a, I don't even know where I'm going with this at this point. But then infuse the positive energy, come in prepared, and figure out what that means to be prepared and to be helpful.
Is there any advice commonly given in medicine that you believe should be ignored? And I guess I'm talking about this in the context of clinical reasoning or in the context of like learners at any kind of level. Like, what's advice commonly given that you think actually should be ignored, or you would want to be like, you know, you asterisk this advice?
Like, I'm sure there is, but off the top of my head, I don't know. You know, I can think of it in terms of personal statements, which has nothing to do with really this your on the floor thing. But I guess at some point you're going to be writing a personal statement for residency.
Everyone will like
and
writing.
I heard one person say, like, you got to make sure that people you like seeing the accolades of the specialty. And I think that is a waste of space. So when people are writing personal statements, one, it's, I think, just very hard for us. We're not used to, like, tooting our own horns as much. We're not in, like, sales in medicine. A lot of us come in very unsure of ourselves and, you know, try to walk the walk and try to sound confident, but internally you're like, I don't know what's happening. And so we get very uncomfortable and we had to like write our own personal statement. For some people, maybe it comes very intuitively, but a lot of people do not. And yeah, like oftentimes I will see learners write and I would just like strike all these other big, you know, this specialty is amazing because of blank, blank, blank. And I was like, that has nothing in this sentence is anything about you. And the person in theory should already know that. And so like, strike that. So that's one thing I always strike from people's personal statements, which is more of a tangent. With regards to the other, you know, I think the fake it till you make it is one that comes up. And I think there's some truth that you have to sort of do it. But I think this is where we're getting back into the humility and not feeling shame and being a little bit vulnerable actually makes you look smarter. Mm-hmm. So I think I actually recently have seen a couple different learners or I've been thinking about that, who when they make a mistake, they don't own it. Like they'll come up with another reason. And it's not that the reason isn't valid. It's that it's better to take ownership and then explain why you might have done X, Y, Z, if that makes sense. So yes, you sort of have to fake it till you make it, and that like sometimes it is good to sound a little bit more confident than you feel internally if you are aware of yourself as sounding someone who's like not very confident, right? But you also run the risk of sounding overly confident, and that is also very annoying. If a person's so confident when they don't know what's going on, it's much better to be like, oh, I'm not really sure, to accept a certain amount of uncertainty. So some of my favorite phrases, well, actually there's some like Instagram reels on this or something, but for internal medicine, it's like probable, possible, likely, suspected,
possibly.
Like we hedge a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that is helpful because it, on one hand, you know, because like, this is probably a heart failure exacerbation, or this is probably, you know, an appendicitis that needs blank, blank, blank. It still shows that you have some knowledge and some confidence, but also leaves a little bit of room for error, which is very, very nice. Mm-hmm.
Multiple thoughts. One, I guess like kind of going back to the personal statement, and again, this is a tangent, but I still think it's relevant to like, I think it's relevant to people applying to residency and even, you know, residents applying to fellowship, et cetera. Something I find that's hard about, like you just said, the kind of like the tooting your horn, but it's also like this ability to like look back on kind of what you've done and start to connect the dots like that. Again, kind of goes back to this thing we've talked about, like of internal reflection, but also, and I don't know whether like you feel this is true, kind of like being able to tell your story and like kind of like wrap it in a bow in hindsight for somebody else to understand. And I don't mean like wrap it in a bow like it has to be shiny and polished, but just like explaining to someone like that you've thought about how you went from A to B and B to C.
Yeah.
And communicating that story to someone else. Like it doesn't have to be shiny and no stories are like linear.
Sure.
But I wonder, like, are the favorite personal statements that you've read or the ones that really have stood out to you are people, like, being really, like, thoughtful and reflective? Is it people being, like, showing an aspect of, like, authenticity or an aspect of kind of, like, vulnerability in their personal statements? Like, can you be too personal in a personal statement?
Yes, you can be. And I say this as somebody who, like, just kind of says anything I feel like saying for the most part. There's a little bit of packaging that does have to be involved. And so, yeah, and in fact, I'm working on a presentation on how to, like, help faculty edit personal and craft personal statements with medical students, because it's sort of like a hobby interest of mine. And I would say that in the beginning, if you're writing a personal statement, I would just say, write everything. My first personal statement was 4 pages. Nobody wants to read 4 pages, no matter how amazing my story might be. You have to whittle it down to 1 page. All right, so it's a 1-page thing, but you can start by writing everything because you have to figure out what your themes are. And your themes don't come out sometimes, right? Because a lot of times we just go through the motion and then we pick things that seem kind of interesting. And it wasn't like even this career that I've ended up in now, like I didn't like know when I was in medical school or in residency or even when I first started my job that this is the job that I would be doing. Turns out that if you read my personal statement, this job would be perfect for me, but it wasn't part of the plan per se.
Yeah.
And so you just write everything and then you figure out like what your themes are. Other things you can do that are helpful are there are actually these value cards. They're available on the internet. You just type in like value cards and you kind of parse through and figure out like there's then you put them in piles like very important to me, you know, sort of important to me, not important to me. And then you kind of figure out like what values are most important to you. And they're all pretty positive. So you're not going to go wrong in a personal statement because you're not downloading something negative. And then and you pick those that you want to highlight. In terms of crafting a story, I think your word of authenticity is the most important thing. And the reality is you're not going to be able to present all of you on a single page piece of paper. But you want to give enough highlights so someone gets a sense of who you are versus the next candidate and what you care about. Mm-hmm. So of the best personal statements I've read, some of them are because of hardships, because frankly, that needs to be explained. And I had a student who who took time off during medical school. I didn't actually know their grades or anything like that, but they had a really incredible story and probably is one of the best personal statements ever made, because it talks about how they went through the hardship and why they went through the hardship and how they got through the hardship. Because I think with any hardship, and that's true for all of life, is that if you can get through it, it makes you a better person. And I got that actually from a former heroin user when I was in residency, who was working in a drug rehab clinic. And I was like, really hard, given that addiction is a lifelong, illness, like to be around people who use substances all the time. And he's like, but your gifts and your wounds lie close together. And I have thought about that like 1,000 times over.
Yeah.
That your gifts and your wounds lie close together.
I love that.
And the thing is, it's only like a gift if like you've worked through the wound. Like if you're still stuck and you haven't done the work, done the therapy, done the talk, done the time, done the journaling, whatever you need to do to get through it, then it's just a wound and it probably makes you a worse provider. But if you get through it, like that's where your empathy comes from. That's where like a patient's ability to be like, ah, this person is for real and I believe them and I trust them in my, challenging time that I'm coming to see the doctor for. That's true for colleagues. And like, it makes you the colleague that people want to be around because it demonstrates you have self-awareness. And then that also that compassion for your colleagues. Yeah. So your gifts and your wounds lie close together. Write a bunch of stuff, figure out your values, and then figure out how to frame things. So sometimes I will find learners, and all of us, we can get a little cynical. We can have a negative view on things. Sometimes it's part of the humor to help us survive, and that's fine. But you have to make sure you frame it in a way that is, like, you can't insult people in the process, so to speak, even if we all kind of understand that this XYZ thing is less than ideal. So you just have to make sure you get editors who read it. Someone said something really interesting. There's like, if somebody gives you feedback on your personal statement and you don't, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember who said it and I don't remember exactly the wording, but it was along the lines of, you should take that feedback and realize that the thing that you said wasn't received in the way that you meant it. And so you just have to go back and reword it, is more or less what it is. Right? Because sometimes we have a meaning, we have a good intention with it, but the person reading it's like, what, now I feel insulted by it. You're like, I was trying to do it, I was trying to convey this other thing. And so you just need to sort of wordsmith it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I double a lot. And like, not only am I going to be taking this idea of gifts and wounds lying close together, I also feel like it's personally this thing that motivates me. Like, when things feel like failure or things feel like insane hurt, very close on the other side, like closer than you'd think. Not like, and maybe it's years, maybe, and I guess when I say close, not trying to like rush healing or rush kind of reflection, mm-hmm. but like very, very close on the opposite side of like working through something, is then that like you're just kind of articulating this ability to like take what you've learned and it then becomes like a strength of yours. Like a failure can be metamorphosized like into a strength. Or like a pain or a hurt can be metamorphosized into like something that like people admire about you or see in you as a teammate, as like a friend, as a, a parent, as a doctor.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that.
And so there's actually plenty of faculty who will walk around and now tell you like, oh yeah, I got like a C in organic chemistry, or I failed blank, blank, blank in medical school or otherwise, mm-hmm. or I didn't get into my residency until my third try or whatever it may be. Like that certainly happens. On the flip side, and I think it's something interesting that maybe back to your question about advice that people get, and that you're like, don't do it. And granted, that was way more for clinical reasoning, but it's that I actually think there's no shame in quitting.
Hmm.
So there is actually times you need to know that, like, just because you've invested in something, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, years of your life, like, there's no shame in quitting if it is not the right thing. That anyone who's gotten into medical school, I think, has plenty of talents, or has gotten into residency, has plenty of talents, or even has gotten to the attending level, has plenty of talents, and therefore absolutely always has the choice, with no shame, to quit and go do something else.
Hmm.
And I think that's important, because I see people who are like, oh, I've already it's the sunk cost fallacy, right? I mean, it happens to all of us. We're already paid like $100,000 and I don't want to waste that. Or I spent all these years applying to med school and then doing the thing and I feel like I cannot quit. But you also have the rest of your life ahead of you, and it would be a shame to keep struggling in a way that may not be congruent with who they are.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to discount the fact that some people, like, if they don't finish, they don't have a job. If they don't have a job, they can't pay their loans back. And so there are, of course, some real hard, like, financial constraints and things like that,
mm-hmm.
That are very, very real, that can keep people in a position that they don't want to be and they feel stuck. But for the most part, I would say, I mean, even then, like, it may be better to just find some other kind of job and like slowly chip away at it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no shame in quitting. Of course, you know, of course we want people to be successful. We want lots of wonderful people in this job. But I think it's something people don't hear often enough, that we think of quitting as a failure and that we set out to do this thing and we invested all of our time. But I've seen enough people be unhappy at the final product that they have achieved that I think people should feel more okay just being like, you know, I thought this was the right thing for me at the time. I made the best decision I could make based off of the information that I had. And it turns out it wasn't quite the right thing. And I think we should do that with any disappointment we face too, right? People who don't get into certain residencies, like sometimes it's a blessing in disguise and you don't know it at the time. You cannot see that. But then you reflect upon it years later and you're like, oh yeah, you know, it turns out. I mean, just like for me, I thought, you know, neurosurgery would have been a challenge to get into. I could have gotten in according to my advisors, but it was challenging because I didn't do very well on my step one. My mom was very sick at the time. She was hospitalized. I had gone through some other personal stuff, like a bad breakup. And I, like, during this whole step one process, I was like a hot mess. And I didn't score the way that I thought I was going to score. And I had been used to, you know, Ivy League training, like used to scoring like top echelon. And I was like below national average, which at the time was horrifying to me. My mom was just glad that I passed. She was like, oh, I thought you were going to fail. So, okay, there's that. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I have friends who failed step a couple times, and they have also gone on to very successful careers. One makes more money than me as a gastroenterologist. So, again, there are success stories even within the failures. But, yeah, it's just one of those things where there's no shame in quitting. And also sometimes, you do keep going through, and you're getting those eyes close together.
I love it. Directly related to this, can you share a favorite, a favorite failure of your medical journey personally, and something that felt like a setback, but became, I guess, like a gift and a wound for you?
Yeah, well, definitely this job is amazing. So I really like my job. I like how I get to, I always joke that I hang out with young people, right? I meet people like you, right? We get to like hang out and hopefully he's a little bit younger and understand. What can I say about that? Oh my God, you have to repeat the question. I've already lost my train of thought.
I was like saying, can you share a favorite failure in your medical journey that felt like a setback, but it shaped you into a better clinician? And then I'm stealing your phrasing, something that maybe felt like a wound to you at a time, but then became a gift or came a part of like a strength that you actually self-identify.
Oh, I see. So yes. So for me, I mean, it was definitely this whole step thing with my mom and her cancer diagnosis. Like, that was really hard for me. I'm an only child. I was in New York and she was in Chicago. And so there was just a lot of different things. And she was young. My mom was diagnosed at 49. She passed away like just after her 51st birthday.
Thank you.
And so all that was real crappy. Not doing well on step for me was like, at the time, like one of the biggest failures I'd had, in the sense that I just thought it like ruined my chances of neurosurgery. And then I don't think I did all that well during my third year. Like, I was okay, but I wasn't like a top-notch student per se. And so that, I think, to me was just, it was a really hard time. It was also really hard because I was with somebody at the time who I thought I was going to get married to. And so like my whole world was just crumbling. Like of the three most important people, my father, my mother, since I have no siblings, you know, nobody else, and my future significant other, like two out of three were like gone. And you know, through the work world, like some of my best friends have come through that time. Like, I was just on spring break in Cancun with my family and two of my med school friends and their families. And I was like, this is so great that these people who knew me back then, like, we're still friends.
Yeah.
And so that is amazing. I know for sure that I wouldn't have met my now husband. We met 2 days before match day, actually, in Chicago. Terrible time to meet somebody, because then I was like, hey, I'm moving 2,000 miles away to Oregon. Well, you live here in Chicago, and we did 3 years of long distance. Or if I had gone into neurosurgery, like, I wouldn't have met him because I'd be in training or I'd be in New York or somewhere else. Now, maybe I'd have his other wonderful life, like, with some other person and other, I don't know if I'd have kids or not, for instance. But the reason I have kids and all those sort of things is because of that. And then I, you know, everyone's good at different things. And I've sort of mentioned that I think I probably would not, I think I would have been a good surgeon, but I'm not the person who did the same thing over and over again. So I don't think I would have loved it the way that other people love it. And the thing with medicine now is that because of, unfortunately, my mom's experience and the death, and I would consider the early death of my mom like a pretty strong wound. And unfortunately, my dad also eventually passed away, is that I'm really good at goals of care discussions. And so that's where, for me, when I say your gifts and your wounds like close together, like that's where it is. Like this horrible thing that happened, which is that my mom passed away very, very young. Like I'm still mad about it because I feel like it's not even like I miss her, but also like I'm just mad she didn't get to experience more life. She didn't get to see me in my adulthood, that I didn't get to take care of her with my attending salary. And she didn't get to interact with these grandkids, right? And, like, my dad also didn't get that much time. Like, neither of them quite reached retirement. That I'm like, what? Like, I'm so mad about it on their behalf.
Yeah.
So every time I have a cancer patient, the reality is, and especially when they're young, like, I spend a lot of time in that room. You know, you talked about as a medical student, you feel so lucky with, like, one or two patients, you can go to the bedside. I think even people who are older should remember that, like, there are times that it is worth taking that extra time. Mm-hmm. So I was just doing this admitter shift on Friday, and I met a patient. He was young, and I spent like, much to the probably chagrin of my colleagues who were admitting a bunch of other patients, but I probably spent like a good hour in that patient's room. And other people, I spent like, 10 minutes, because they didn't need that much. Like a quick ICU transfer, everything was pretty stable. I checked in, had a quick interview, exam, and then like wrote my note and was done. Whereas this patient, like, they were coming in and they had just received word that their cancer was progressing. It was kind of like there's writing on the wall. And in order to actually do my baseline job, which was to do things including asking about code status, it's like, oh man, I'm asking code status on this person who has been full code, it's a metastatic cancer that is spreading. Like, it's like, I know where this is headed.
Yeah.
Like, how do I engage in this discussion in a thoughtful way? And it just cannot be done quickly. Right? Like, because if you do it, you come across callous and it can cause distress for your patients and anxiety. And so you really have to take that time. And so I was in there for a long time. And I got to know, like, all sorts of things that you would argue that were not very efficient. Like, I got to know who his family was a little bit more, like, who he lived with. I actually found out, like, where his wife works. But some of these things are important as you really get to know a patient. And for me, I tried to then convey it in my note to save my colleague time. So with the idea that, like, yes, it seems like maybe I'm not being the most efficient, but I felt like I'm providing high quality care. I'm giving the patient what they need at the time. I was able to do so in a way that was not, like, I ended up staying an extra hour past my shift. So I don't think I'd fully, put extra work on my colleagues per se. I ended up seeing a couple of the patients that night. But it is one of those things where it feels weird to say you're good at goals of care discussions and end-of-life discussions, but I think since I've been on the other side, to the degree that you can be without it being your own life trajectory, that it's something that I connect with people with, and I read people pretty well, and I've done it multiple times over and over. It is very draining, though, and I find that the next day I just want to, like, lay in bed and not do anything at all.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. That's, like, awesome. Not awesome in that a bad, like, painful things that happen, but in that you've kind of been able to, like, use that now as like a skill set or a chunk.
Yeah, it gives actually some weird meaning to my parents' deaths. You know, of course, I'd rather they'd be around, yeah. And I'd rather not have this meaning. But since it has happened, I agree. It's one of those things that it's kind of nice to be able to then offer this to someone else's journey, and it actually helps me feel like my parents kind of live on.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else wrote in a book that I was reading, the little dedication was like, this is dedicated to my parents. You know, their vitality lives on in me. And I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of like that. I'm going to take that.
I love that. You kind of described this feeling like maybe on the days where you do feel the days, for example, the days after a goal of care conversation where you said, like, you kind of just want to, like, lie in bed and veg. Or, like, what do you do for yourself, I guess, like, on those days? Because you're busy. You take on this, like, mental load, emotional load, physical load. You have a family. What are you, like, how do you, I guess, do you personally fight, like, this phrase we use of burnout? Yeah. Like, how do you kind of take care of yourself so that you can show up for, like, people in your personal life, your colleagues, like, what is, how do you kind of like battle burnout, I guess?
Yeah, so I haven't figured it out yet. Part of the problem is like, so recently I've discovered that, my extroversion is putting me into a weird place. I was an introvert growing up. I think I was like the shy kid where parents teacher conferences, they'd all the teachers would tell my parents like, well, Christine seems to know what's going on, but like she doesn't say very much in class. And I had like plenty of friends. I wasn't like the most quiet person in the classroom. But I would like, you know, went over to the teacher's like, what's the answer? I was never the person to raise my hand, right? For that same shame that all medical students feel. I'm pretty sure in medical school, I cannot remember now, but I was not the person to raise my hand and be super engaged in the large group conversation. In a small group, I had no problem.
Hearing yourself identify as an introvert is baffling.
Right? Yeah, it's very weird now. And now I'm like on the other end of the spectrum. I had a former medical student who became one of my residents say, he's like, I'm painfully extroverted. And I was like, I think I'm becoming like this person. I'm also becoming painfully extroverted. So the challenge, this is a long-winded way, as you can see, this podcast is going to go on forever. Sorry, people who are listening, is that I get energy from talking to other people, but then it's also simultaneously draining, and I don't always know where my limit is.
Mm.
And also, because my parents passed early, I tend to have very little tolerance for delayed gratification, which medicine is all about delayed gratification, right? Like, you have friends who have paying jobs right now.
Ooh,
you are paying money for the privilege of being here.
Yes.
And then you will be paid a little bit of money to work a lot for the privilege of working a lot.
Yes.
And then you become attending and you realize, oh, you have money, but actually no, because your expenses are like crazy up the wazoo, because that's just the way it goes. For things that are restorative, I would say, you know, I actually once I learned something called Vedic meditation, transcendental meditation, from a former Rush hospitalist who became a meditation teacher. And she ran a retreat for women in healthcare at the time, and other people teach it too. And I found other people I've ran into, like meditation is actually very important. There's mindfulness meditation, but this transcendental meditation is actually a very different style. So I think for those people who are like, mindfulness is not for me, look into this other kind of meditation if you have to find the right kind of teacher. So those taking a deep breath, taking these breaks is very, very helpful. I like to have sort of deep times away from work. And I didn't forget that I have that job. I think I compartmentalize somewhat well. And even on like my own service, I go around in the morning with my residents. I mean, if we're on a non-admitting day in the afternoon, I forgot I went to work in the morning. And I was like, I mean, my pager's still on fine, but like, for the most part, like, especially because the medicine residents are highly capable, like, they just handle everything. They're only going to call me if there's, like, something that really needs my assistance.
Yeah.
I do have a job that I enjoy, so that is always very helpful. But, yeah, I think being an extrovert, I'm struggling because, actually, I tend to say no to very little things, and it's not because I feel shame or pressure. It's because I actually want to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a friend coming into town. She's like, hey, do you want to come to this dinner? And it's like the night before I start a 4-day service where I'm working like 12 hours a day. Like, I probably shouldn't say yes to this thing. It's probably going to make me very tired. On the other hand, reconnecting with a friend from college and interacting with a bunch of like entrepreneurs probably could be really fun.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a mix of you need alone time, reflection time, and whether that's listening to a podcast to get food for thought, listening to music, exercise is super important. I'm a chronic non-exerciser. But I always feel good afterwards. So I started doing like high intensity interval training-ish. I would call them medium intensity because I just don't go that intense with it. And there are no monitors, kind of like the Orange Theory type thing. But there's a gym like right near my house. And when I can make it, I go there. They just tell me what to do. It's nice because there's no cognitive load.
Yeah.
This person told me what to do.
Yeah.
They play loud music and I just do what they told me to do.
You just dissociate with your body.
And I just move my body. So that's really good. So it's all the sort of usual things. I need a lot of sleep. I'm one of those people that like likes 9 hours of sleep, which is impossible. I can do 7, but I kind of wish I could operate on like 6, and that's not true for me.
Oh,
sleep is good. I haven't figured that out yet. You're supposed to have digital mindfulness and be like away from your screen. So I'm not good at that either. But that's because I find Instagram kind of hilarious. There's all sorts of funny things that show up on my personal algorithm. And then I like send them to all my other friends and I feel more connected.
Yeah.
So I haven't answered your question, but I think ultimately the solution is going to be some component of personal time away and social time, where you're engaged with the community, and whether that community is your family, your friends, people in medicine, people outside of medicine.
Something that I guess, I'll try to keep it moving because I have a few more questions. But like, everything that you're saying is like resonating with me. I think that I also find this tough like balance between introversion and extroversion that I self-identify as an introvert. And similarly, people be like, what are you talking about? Like, you can talk forever. Or like, what are you talking about? Like, you like to sit and have these like intense one-on-one conversations. Like, what do you mean? Like, you're the person that like at dinner is like having this like intense eye contact with everyone. And it's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, no, actually, I even like, not only is that recharging to me, but I almost like have reclaimed that as an introverted thing where I'm like, I do get recharged by one-on-one and like intense one-on-one. And socializing with people that I love and that know me because I can be entirely myself.
Yeah.
Me at a dinner party of six acquaintances, like I'm feeling myself like slowly
yeah.
withering. But if I'm at like a one-on-one dinner with like someone that I love,
yeah,
I'm like teed in the entire time. And I walk away from that feeling like lighter.
Yeah.
And like you said, like that dinner with a best friend from college the night before starting work. As long as I get to bed at like 9 o'clock or something like that, 10 o'clock, that is what's going to get me through like the day after that.
So the challenge, though, is in medicine, you start to ask very invasive. You get used to asking invasive questions to people. And therefore, you get to know people very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you have lots of best friends. And that is where I am running into trouble, which is that because I think most of it, especially I've heard like post-pandemic, people just don't have time for that like small talkiness. Like,
yeah, I hate it. They hate small talk.
Extroverts really like small talk. They also like to get to the meat of things. Like, I want to sit around talking to like six people about the weather or like inane things, like superficial stuff. Yeah. Like, but the challenge is that I'm pretty open, and then I ask him what I would say are invasive questions when I want to say it. Not nicely, but the reason is people are open to sharing because I'm always like, well, fine, share. You don't have to say anything about yourself.
Yeah.
But then we're constantly having these intense, in-depth discussions with people I just met, and so you're like. Sort of like fast friends.
Yeah.
And then you get into trouble.
I wonder, like, you get into trouble, but then I wonder too, you said that, and I'm like, that's the level at which I interact, where we get used to asking these really invasive questions. I actually feel like interactions see them liberate people, like talking to women about menorrhagia, like, or like talk, like, it's like you're talking to someone about these very intimate things, but you actually see them being like, liberated, validated, yes. Seen, getting an opportunity to talk about this. But then I come into issues where I take that level of like, this is me at a party on a Friday night. Yes. It's like, I go into the party and like, this is the introvert in me where like, I'm just looking kind of like, I'm gravitating towards who's going to be the person that will engage with me on that way. Yeah. And some people surprise me and be like, don't seem to like that yeah. at all. But I'm like, we don't have to talk about the philosophy of life, but why can't you even tell me about like the show you're watching? But like, with let's have the passion and engagement. Like, we can talk about television, but like, let's really like be here with one another. Yeah. And that's the thing that I find like challenging in today's age is that like some people seem to like shy away from like intimacy or feel it as like uncomfortable. And I think we're just like on the opposite side of like, that's what we do kind of for a job. And then it kind of like fits with your personality where you're like, it feels amazing to be seen like that.
Yeah.
And I want to see people like that. And I'm so desperate to be seen like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of it is that, so a very interesting concept that came to me from one of the Hidden Brain podcasts was this idea of dignity society versus honor society. With the idea of dignity being more like what we have in the U.S., like everybody has dignity and value regardless of who they are, right? This is where we have our disability rights, our DEI work, and all these things. I'm like, doesn't matter who you are, where you came from, or where you frankly have to, quote unquote, contribute from a productivity standpoint to society, you have dignity. Honor society, I think of it like traditional Chinese, like
filial piety.
Filial piety, you bring shame upon your family if you do, you know, and I think a lot of people still have that strong, like, honor society thing. So that, because if somebody, some people don't want to get because they just don't have the energy to do
sure.
it. Or they're just not in a space to be able to do so. But when it comes from some people don't know how to engage. They're shy. They're anxious. There's all these other things going on. Going back to that philosophy of like, if people show up to try to do a good job, including being a social engaged person at a party, like it doesn't have to be like a work thing. Some people have all these other barriers. At the same time, like some of it is, oh my God, I lost my train of thought. And where am I going with this?
Dignity society.
Oh, yeah. So, honor society. So if they come from an honor society, like, and society can just be like your family, your upbringing, they may not be like, they haven't been given the okay to share.
Yeah.
And so for me, this other weird liberating thing of having parents who are not alive, being from an immigrant family, is that there's no one I need to honor except for myself. Like I'm not going to bring shame upon anybody. I mean, I could bring shame upon my children and my husband, but, you know, for the most part, not really. And it does make it very freeing for me to be able to speak my mind for the, you know, within some set of boundaries. It's not that I have no boundaries whatsoever. Boundaries are important. But yeah, some people just don't have that. And some of them are just kind of awkward. And we have to be mindful of all of our energies. That if you go to a party and you're like, wow, that was not that exciting, and I just feel drained afterwards, all we made was small talk and I couldn't find anyone to connect with. Yeah, I probably wouldn't go to that party again the next time either. I'd be like, oh, thanks for the invite. That was pretty nice of you to think of me. And then like disengage.
I can think of like a party that I went to where like me and one girl just got to talking and we went from everything from like IUDs to cats to the challenges of how the heck do you make friends like in your 20s or like dating in this environment. And then like, how do I we're back to talking about like our favorite places to go get like our nails done. And like, it's this kind of like, but there's this dynamicism between light and heavy, but there's like, it's just, there's something about like, you're just with someone in that. So I don't know. Okay. So a few more questions for you. Okay. One more, the feature of medicine.
Mm.
I'll ask this broadly because I know that you can take this exactly where you want this.
Okay.
What excites you the most about the feature of medicine or clinical reasoning? Because you referenced earlier on in the conversation this idea of like, pick a job too that like, you could see what it looks like in 10 years.
Yeah.
I know what internal medicine is going to look like in 10 years, or like, how do you know that? Or what do you think the feature of your field is?
Mm. Yes. It's a good question. We don't always know, of course, right? Like, I predict what surgery will be like. I don't know if it's exactly like that. I think there's still plenty of things. I guess also, think about the worst part of the job, too, of, like, are you going to be able to okay with that thing? Like, for me, the worst part is trying to figure out if people are drug-seeking, like, opioid pain. Like, you know, not pain-seeking, because that sounds like masochism, but, like, drug-seeking, or if they actually have pain that's undertreated, right? That's, like, a weird thing. I was like, I didn't come here to be a lie detector. I don't know how to do it. But for the future of medicine, I think everyone's talking about AI and wondering what that's all about. Some people think it's going to replace us, but I don't think so. Because at the end of the day, for clinical reasoning to be a clinician, one who's less procedure oriented and more like brain, not that, sorry, if my surgeons don't hear their brains, they do too. But at the end of the day, they have something that like nobody else can do, which is that like the operation has to be done by a person and observed and all these sorts of things. Although I guess there's some robotic AI that's happening too. But so AI is changing things, and I actually think it's probably changing things for the better, because right now there's so much cognitive overload on all of our clinicians, right, that even when we go to, like, open evidence, it can, like, quickly summarize, like, what the evidence is. And sometimes you have to, like, make sure it's, like, a real article, and, like, the AI still has its issues, right? There's, like, these hallucinations they have where they, like, cite things that don't exist.
Someone just talked to me about
this. So you have to be very careful. But the thing is, we, like, a couple people are like, AI is just going to replace doctors. I was like, I don't think so, because you still have years of education and experience that help you filter what you are reading, right? What you read still has to be filtered. I have some friends in business, and they're like, every time I, like, they'll ask me a question of something I don't know that much about. So I'm like, on Google, searching for things. And they're like, this is not helping Dr. Google very much. That, like, if my doctor is Googling, then why wouldn't I just directly Google? I was like, yeah, but you don't have the lens to filter out the stuff that's garbage from the stuff that is true. And so I think what is exciting for me is that like right now I'm sort of playing around with the ChatGPT open evidence, which is better because it actually has PubMed related articles than journal. And it'll help me quickly summarize, so I have a better sense of what I'm going to do. I can work a little bit faster. And that can actually get me either a component of more time at the bedside with the patient, because now I, like, instead of spending like 30 minutes trying to figure out the answer to a question and then calling 3 consultants to try to figure it out, maybe ChatGPT or this AI thing has helped me, like, narrow the direction I want to go in a little bit faster, and especially to give me the evidence that I can feel a little bit more confident in it. Buys me more time for that. Buys me, you know, talk about burnout, like, I'm less burnt out. And I actually think it's still helpful. And I don't know that it's necessarily replacing us, because nothing can really replace the authenticity of a human.
I hope
the hand holding, the physical touch component, right? The physical exam. Sometimes you're like, well, what's the point of the physical exam when you have all these like CT scans and MRIs and ultrasounds? But there's something about laying a hand on a patient. We don't know, like, some people like don't get much physical contact, right? Mm-hmm. The Surgeon General at one point said that loneliness was one of the big epidemic.
And that could be a whole other podcast.
Right. But I think that's true for some of our patients. They actually like love being in a hospital sometimes because people are coming in. Like, how are you doing? How are you feeling right now? Checking in on them. They're having conversations. They're engaging with youthful, energetic folks. Even no matter how tired you look as a med student or resident, like there's still certain like positive energy to walking into that.
Someone's making the bed for them. Someone's tucking them in. When's the last time someone's tucked you in? Like, you know?
Yeah. And of course, some people hate it. They're like super independent. They're like, I do not like it being here. I'm in no control. The door is open all the time. You know, it's not a place for rest. But certainly, I think AI is pretty exciting. I mean, it's here whether we like it or not. There are things certainly to be nervous about. And yeah, am I going to be replaced? Maybe am I going to be asked to do like 50,000 other things maybe. But if it can decrease my cognitive load, that I actually have time to fully think and be thoughtful and engage in human-to-human interaction, then it's absolutely a win.
Okay, a few now, just some rapid-fire questions.
All right.
Describe your happy place.
Somewhere in nature. Looking at stars is a happy place. Being with my family. Snuggling my kids and stuff. It's like super fun. Happy place. Socializing, being with girlfriend, super happy place. But yeah, I would say nature is the one thing that, you know, is ironic because I'm a city dweller through and through. Like we live downtown. I like being able to like walk my kids to school and, you know, walk to the pharmacy and walk everywhere if I want to. I could walk to work if I felt like it. I don't, but I could. But then being out in nature is very important, whether it's water, mountains, skiing. I'll try not to get injured. I know so many people have gotten injured skiing this past year. And then anywhere I can see, like the Milky Way is like
beautiful.
What is the last rabbit hole that you found yourself fall down?
I don't know. Like, internet is definitely a rabbit hole where you wander into. But right now, I'm very interested in this idea of just thinking about chronic stress and how that affects us and the gut microbiome and all these things that are like, they're coming into more mainstream allopathic medicine, but they're still kind of on the fringes of them.
I love the gut microbiome.
Like, I don't know that 95% of your serotonin is produced in the gut. Weird factoid that I just learned recently. And I was like, oh, so I'm supposed to be eating and all the whole foods and all these things, but it's very time consuming. I don't have any energy for it. Talk about what brings me. I was like, thinking about what I'm going to make for dinner every night.
Yeah.
It's very draining. But it doesn't have to be draining. It's just where I am right now. I was like, okay, I need to create more bandwidth so that that becomes like a fun thing again.
Yeah. Okay. My last question, what is a smell that has an instant association of a memory for you?
A smell. I don't know. These days, I'm just like trying all sorts of different perfumes. I get like thousands of little samples from different places that I like. Yeah, instant memory. Because I want to think of a positive smell. There's so many negative smells.
Especially in medicine.
That you don't want.
Yeah.
But what's coming to mind right now is just roses. And I don't know why. It's not a specific memory, but I think there's just something peaceful about, well, not all rose fragrances, but many rose fragrances and whatever they mix into that particular line feels a little bit refreshing and warm.
Bright.
And lovely and bright.
Feel like you're out in nature.
Yeah. I don't want like old lady rose, like stagnant floral smell, but like some kind of like light floral. And it's almost spring. Yeah. No, it is spring. We are in spring. It feels like winter.
Even though kind of
it might snow this week in Chicago, but yeah, let's say rose.
Okay.
Smell the rose.
And then my final question, is there one kind of like final word or piece of advice you want listeners to take away from their journey or expertise?
And what is it? So much pressure.
Okay. What's your sign off? Is your exiting stage left? Like, I guess what are your thoughts? If you want someone to kind of remember anything?
I guess it's back to the your gifts and your wounds lie close together, and that, you know, you can, there's lots of things you can do that will bring you joy. So, you know, don't overstress it. Easier said than done. Don't overstress it. But just remember that your gifts and your wounds lie close together, and there's multiple paths that you can take that will be very fulfilling and lead to an amazing life.
Thank you, Dr. Tsai.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.